Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy, and it's good to have you here with us. You can get a hold of me on Twitter, at Ryan Ballingy, R-Y-A-N-B-A-L-L-E-N-G-E-E. And you can find Golf News Net on your favorite social media service at the handle Golf News Net. All of our work is on golfnewsnet.com, and you can download our apps for Amazon Fire and Roku TVs. So this week's show is about the match, Tiger Woods versus Phil Mickelson. I'm sure many of you saw it. Based on the numbers from John Orand at Sports Business Daily and Sports Business Journal, Bleacher Report says they got about 750,000 unique people to stream or unique streams of the match, which turned out to be free because of some kind of glitch on their end, their technology, and trying to process payments and get things going. And they just decided, screw it, we're going to make it free. And so ultimately, 750,000 people took advantage of that and watched at least some portion of the match on television. Obviously, some other probably a couple hundred thousand people might have watched it on pay-per-view elsewhere in North America. And then even farther than that, you know, in the UK and New Zealand, Australia, and some other countries, it was actually just showed on TV, on regular TV. Like, it wasn't pay-per-view. They just put it on the air. So probably several million people, you know, I would guess 2 million people in the end, probably wound up watching at least one portion or another of the match, whether they paid for it or not, whether they were in the United States or not, wherever they came from. So a pretty solid audience for something that's never been done before and something that's unique in the sport. And I think in that sense, it was a success. And so when this was announced, you know, months ago that this would be Black Friday, that it would be in Vegas, all this stuff, I was certainly interested in making sure that we covered it in some fashion. I thought about going to Las Vegas. Las Vegas is one of my favorite places on the entire planet. As many of you know, I'm kind of a blackjack fiend, although I haven't played very much lately in the last couple of years since kind of running this and having children makes it a little bit more difficult. But I do still love blackjack. I do still love a good gamble, and obviously I love golf. And so I love heading into Sin City when I can. But it being Black Friday, being the day after Thanksgiving, it's really hard for me to justify going to Vegas, spending the money, doing all of that stuff for an 18-hole match and effectively missing one of my favorite holidays with my family, not only my wife and kids, but also my parents, her parents, and all those things, just so I could go watch a superfluous golf match. So I was very fortunate that Darren Bunch, who's on our team, wanted to do that. And as you'll hear in the interview I recorded with Darren earlier today, he was able to go because his family in Las Vegas. His wife is from the area, is from Las Vegas. He spent plenty of time there, professionally speaking, was the Sunday editor for the Las Vegas Review Journal, ran a magazine called Fairways and Greens with Vic Williams. I think I believe he now runs Golf Tips magazine. And then that turned into Golf Getaways, hence the name Golf Getaways on our website for our travel section. And it's going to turn into, turned into Talking Golf Getaways, the podcast with him and Mitch Lawrence, which hopefully you're listening to and regularly subscribe to. And we're going to turn our travel expertise and our travel team, him, Mitch, Brian Orr, who does photography for us sometimes, Tony Deere, who writes for us sometimes, Jay Flemma does some architecture sometimes, and Eric Hart, who does a bunch of kind of golf resort reviews from a more family perspective for us. We're going to turn that into its own website. It's going to be its own golf travel website. We're going to kind of challenge Golf Advisor and do something a little bit differently than they do, but still get in kind of the golf travel space. So I actually just bought the domain before we started recording this, called golftripexperts.com. So that's going to come in the next few weeks. So stay tuned for that. We'll let you know more about that. But so fortunately, Darren was available and wanted to do it and asked if he would be able. I said, yeah, of course. I would love for you to be able to do that. So we set up got the credentials all set up. Fortunately, again, he was close by and could kind of roll with the punches a little bit because the credentialing process was not as smooth as your typical PGA Tour event. Kind of came together last minute, but it got done. We got approved, and he went ahead and went to cover it. So that worked out really well. And so Darren was on the ground. He wrote, I think, three stories for us. So one about Shadow Creek, one about the lead-up to the match, and obviously a gamer, which was fantastic. You should read all of those at golfnewsnet.com. But I wanted to have him on the podcast because he was there, and there's so much that we could talk about that didn't fit neatly into a single story that we could go over the action, the vibe, what went right, what went wrong, what could change, could they do it again? And so I wanted to kind of go over all of those things as well as walk through some of the tropes about the match that probably turned out not to be all that accurate and turned out to kind of be disproven in some of the end results, even despite the technical glitches and other issues with it. So Darren and I recorded a conversation. I think it's like 50 minutes. I don't know what the end result is. Once we get done editing, I'll know. But we talked for quite a while and had an absolute blast doing it. So I wanted to have that for you, and you can listen to that after this. Before we get to Darren, though, I do want to tell you about our friends at AutoSlash. We've been telling you for weeks about AutoSlash, and we're so happy to have them on as a sponsor. And the reason I'm happy to have them on is because of how much travel that I wind up doing. And I thought about this over the holidays, too, even though I didn't leave the D.C. metro area. I thought about the hassle and horror of traveling around Thanksgiving and thought about AutoSlash a little bit. So I'm glad to be telling you about them again. You may know, I probably don't have too many great experiences renting a car. It's not that much fun. It can kind of be annoying. You have to kind of go to the counter and sign all kinds of crap. You sign your life away. Then you might get a crappy car. You might get a good car. You might get a good rate. You might get a bad rate. And at least with AutoSlash, you can now know that you're going to get the absolute best price, the absolute best rate available to you when you book, when you show up at the counter, or, for that matter, if you book in advance. AutoSlash is a free service which makes sure you get the best rate possible when you need to rent a car, even after you book, whether you prepay or whether you rent at the counter. And it saves you money in two ways. When you book your car rental, AutoSlash we'll search for all of the car rental providers at your pickup location to find you the best possible rate, applying every possible coupon code available to you, those available to the public or those reserved for people that are members of organizations like Costco or AAA. You might be able to save money on a car rental and you might not even know it, but AutoSlash does. After you book, AutoSlash then keeps looking for better rates until the very second you pick up your car rental. Rates can drop without warning sometimes. I've experienced this personally. And AutoSlash is there to make sure you're aware of those better rates through either your rental company you chose when you originally booked or with another one offering a better, more competitive rate. So you can book, rebook, and rebook again and save the most money. It doesn't cost you anything to do that. In addition to helping you save on those pay-at-the-counter rentals, AutoSlash offers what's called slash deals for huge discounts on those prepaid rentals. And those are actually refundable up to 48 hours before you pick up your car, which does not happen with a lot of places. A lot of those travel sites, Hotwire, Hotels.com, Priceline, when you rent a car through them, you're paying for it up front and you can't change. You're stuck. You can't get refunded. You just lose your money. And so with these slash deals from AutoSlash, that's a huge deal. The average AutoSlash customer saves about 30% on their rental, so that means you can expect to save about that much on your rental, and that means you're going to have a little bit more money in your pocket for your traveling for fun with yourself, with your family, with loved ones, or if you're running a business, save a little bit of money on your car rental expenses and push that to other portions of your business. So try AutoSlash for yourself. It's free, quick, easy. Head to autoslash.com. You input to AutoSlash your location, your travel dates, as well as those potential membership discounts that they ask you about. And it'll work its magic. And before you know it, you'll have an email in your inbox with those mind-blowing rates for your rental. Try AutoSlash one more time, autoslash.com. All right, so here's our interview with Darren. Hope you enjoy the conversation, and then we'll come back at the end. Darren Buds joins me, and I wanted to have Darren on because, as you may know or may not know, and hopefully you do know, Darren is one of the co-hosts of the Talking Golf Getaways podcast here on Golf News Net. He coached that show with Mitch Lawrence, and it's one of the favorite things that we do at GNN because it's a golf travel-oriented podcast. They talk about destinations. They talk about their experiences, love for the game. It's really kind of an inspiring show. And so Darren's typically working for us
in the space of talking about golf, golf travel, golf architecture. But he, for many years, was the Sunday editor of the Las Vegas Review-Journal. He's covered professional golf in a variety of capacities over the years. He was the owner of Fairways and Greens magazine, which became Golf Getaways magazine. So the guy's been around. He knows golf, and he knows the Las Vegas golf scene as well as anybody humanly possible. So it kind of worked out just perfectly that he was able to go from his home in Bakersfield, California, to visit some family in Las Vegas, stay in the area, go to Shadow Creek, and be our eyes and ears on the ground for the match, Tiger Woods versus Phil Mickelson. So I wanted to have him on the show to talk about his experience, what he enjoyed, what he didn't, what he would recommend they do in the future if it, you know, if this concept were to be continued. And so, Darren, first, thanks for coming on. I wanted to get your impressions immediately of showing up to Shadow Creek on Black Friday, getting ready to cover this thing, and how did the scene feel to you as it was kind of starting to swell up to that 3 p.m. Eastern tee off, and then your initial impressions as the match actually got started?
Well, thanks for being on, Ryan. And to me, it was a very interesting event. Obviously, as you mentioned, I've been to a lot of golf events over the years, over the last three decades. And, they're typically a big giant zoo. You know, you're trying to fight for every spot, and you got to stake out where you're going to be. You know, I've gone to golf tournaments. I went to the Las Vegas Invitational when it was there and basically sat on one hole for the entire, you know, the entire day, because trying to get from hole to hole is such a hassle. And with this event where, you know, essentially maybe 1,000 people out there, it was about, 500 or so of MGM Resorts International's closest friends, and then a horde of media from all over the place, to be honest, more media than I expected even. So you were able to walk along this from hole to hole. I skipped around, kind of got my spot in a couple of places. Like I went straight to the number one green, first hole green, because I wanted to have a really good front row seat to watch Phil eventually miss that $200,000 putt. But the atmosphere of it, of just being up close and personal and intimate, was very cool. And I don't think, I've seen so many people out there say, well, they need to open up the gates, they need to invite more people, it needed to be open to the public. I don't think you can do that with two people. Yeah. I think people aren't thinking, they're thinking in terms of a big event where if you've got 144 players, you've spread people across the golf course and you spread the patrons across the golf course as well. And that's, you can't do that with these two guys. You've got two guys on the golf course. Everybody wants to be around them. And if you get more than about the 1,000 that were out there, all of a sudden the viewing experience for the people who are there, goes down severely, I would think, because, there were still spots where I couldn't get a glimpse of, Tiger or Phil swinging because, it was 5, 6, 7 rows back, in odd spots, in the fairways. But, the good thing is Shadow Creek is a great place for that kind of viewing. There's a lot of sunken greens. So you have some elevation you can watch from. For example, on the 17th, where Tiger chipped in, I actually watched that from the 15th tee box and had a perfect view down into the little amphitheater that is the 17th green. As an overall event, it was a spectacle, but it was an intimate spectacle, I guess would be the way to say it.
That's really interesting you say that about it being a good viewing course, because that would seem the last thing in Tom Fazio's mind when he designed this place, that people would want to watch golf there. I mean, I know that there was a Champions Tour, Senior Tour at the time event there in the 90s. Bob Casper from Utah was telling me in a spot on his show about how his dad, Billy Casper, was playing in the event, always loved playing there, and really enjoyed the golf course the few years that he got to play there. But, I mean, this is the most private, most ultra-private of sort of publicly accessible golf courses that there are. So having been there, you wrote in your preview pieces that you've been able to play there a couple of times. To you, was it kind of jarring to have even 500 or 1,000 people, whatever that kind of number was, following action around on a golf course that sees, what, less than 10 groups a day?
Yeah, well, I mean, when you think about it, this place, and there were some great pictures that went around on social media from back in the early early years of the golf course, where it's sitting out there in North Las Vegas all by itself, and there's nothing but desert all around. And Fazio and Steve Wynn, the owner at the time, they had to build this thing. They had to dig it down and into the ground, because they wanted to create this oasis out there that was never going to feel like it was a part of anything. I don't think they could have seen at the time that North Las Vegas would grow, you know, right around this course out there. But because they had to dig it down and they had to create kind of their own elevation changes throughout the property, that's what gives you those kind of higher viewing areas, on the margins of the holes. And it worked out perfectly. And the facility as a whole held up very well to have that number of people. You're right. I've been out there. I think the day Vic Williams was my partner at Fairways and Greens magazine for a number of years. The first time we played it, there were maybe eight people on the golf course all day, and we only saw three of them, and they played through us at a spot. It was a group of high rollers that blazed through us because we weren't playing fast enough, because we were walking, and those guys were jetting around in carts. So, but it held up nicely, but some of that too is, like I said, that the fact they had moving ropes, which you don't get to see at PGA Tour events usually. Yeah. It was more like at the amateur or something like that, on the final hole when everybody gets to walk down the fairway behind the leaders. In this case, it was like you got to do that on every hole, basically. Yeah. Once they got to the fairway, guys just moved along with ropes and you stood behind the ropes, but you walked, you walked the entire fairway if you wanted to behind the players. And that part of it was very cool.
The interesting thing to me, and you probably didn't catch this because you were standing at the first green, but coming off the first tee, Tiger and Phil felt like they were kind of forced to talk to each other, like someone told them, you should talk to each other. And they were talking about, like, their kids and, that this was great and they could see them. It just did not seem natural at all. And I'm wondering if, from what you saw in the initial holes, that not just their conversations but their golf, did it seem kind of unnatural for them how they were acting and the way they were playing?
Well, yeah, and I think this was the biggest flaw in the event overall, is that if you were on the ground, you never quite knew what was going on. Sure, there was a guy who at the end of each hole announced what the score was, but this kind of, in some ways forced interaction, I guess. But unless you were standing like right on the tee when they made one of the side wagers, and the side wagers is a whole nother issue we need to get into, but unless you were standing right there, you just didn't really know. It was hard to keep track of what was going on. And since the side wagers was the thing that had been so hyped, along with the $9 million, obviously, it felt to me like that was the way, that was one of the things that really they should have focused on. And I've heard some rumors about the side wagers. I don't know, Ryan, you might know this more than me. I heard that the PGA Tour capped how many they could do or something like that, which seems to be the exact opposite of what they should have done for this, because I felt like there should have been way more side wagering, but not every side wager needed to be $100,000. Some of them could have been 10 or 20 or 25. I mean, we're just talking about building up cash for charity here and putting a little extra heat on a guy. I don't understand why there wasn't, you had three closest to the pins, essentially, on the little 93-yard shot at the end. Why was not every one of those worth 50 grand or something like that on top of the fact that they were trying to win 9 million? But, my solution for this, and I was at, coincidentally, in Las Vegas. I was out there when Jack Nicklaus opened up a golf course called Bear's Best.
Yep.
And when he went hole to hole and played this round of golf, and they had a mobile speaker out there set up on a golf cart. And so they were able to talk, and the crowd that was assembled that was walking along with them got to hear what everybody was saying, out loud. I think this event needs that kind of thing. I'm of the other opinion. There are some people who think they should take the mics away from the players. I think you need an on-course host. I think you need an MC. You know, Shane Bacon would have been done a great job at that. You know, his role for people who were there on the golf course was largely, you know, unheard, because he was basically doing these pieces that showed up on BR Live in some ways and or showed up on their social media. And to have somebody who literally is talking to those guys all the time, and when we get to a hole, you know, if Phil's in a bunker, you know, he looks at Tiger and goes, "Hey, we got any side wagers on this bunker shot?" You know, to try to force that action and that interaction in a way that seems much more natural than just saying, "Oh, you guys remember you're mic'd and you need to talk to each other." I think that would be a much better way, and it would allow the patrons to get into the event more, because they would understand more of what's going on. They would hear the chatter between the two of them more, and it would be way better for TV, and you'd need a lot less actually people in the booth, which I think in this event would be much better. I think if it was the two competitors and an MC, that's almost all you would need. Maybe two guys in the booth just to, you know, add color and perspective or something like that from time to time. But so many people I saw on social media, so many people I talked to on the golf course, they wanted to hear these two guys go at each other, and you know, they wanted to hear the needle, as those guys both call it. And I don't think we got enough of that, and I think it's because we didn't have somebody to facilitate it in a way that made sense.
I think that you're right. I feel like they set this thing up and kind of put themselves in this position where they were trying to do two things, and kind of one not very well and one sort of well, and that is that they had this crowd of, you know, 500,000 people, whatever they were, and you didn't really cater to them at all. I mean, it was nice that you could walk, have a walking rope line, and you could kind of stand pretty close to the action, and that was nice, and that probably achieved what they wanted for the MGM Wales and the other VIPs from the sponsors. But like you mentioned, they had no concept of what was going on from the side bets, or really much of anything. They didn't get any of the kind of experience that we were getting watching it on television or streaming it or whatever. So
it seemed
like they reserved everything for this television experience. So why have an audience if you don't want them to know anything, or you don't let them know anything? Because having the audience then can make them more interesting. They can make the reactions a little bit more insightful. I don't know. I feel like
you would hear the oohs and ahs a lot more. You would get what you get at a normal golf tournament more, because people would have a better sense of what's going on. The best commentary I heard all day on the golf course, one of the holes on the front nine, I can't remember where it was, but one of these guys was chipping, and there was a woman standing next to me with two other guys, and somebody asked her, they said, would you pull the flag or not here? And she went through a big description of, you know, if you're chipping, you pull the flag if you think you can get the ball running toward the hole and make it. You leave the flag in if it's a little bit more of a difficult pitch shot. And I thought, well, that's a pretty involved, somewhat complicated, but, you know, higher level thinking of golf strategy from this woman who's just here in the audience standing next to me. And then, of course, I looked up and it was Michelle Wee. So it made sense that she knew what she was talking about.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
And she was there. That was the funny thing. There were, you know, you had all the whales and a lot of people from multiple countries, because obviously MGM caters to an international clientele of high rollers. So many different languages I heard spoken on the golf course that day. But you also then ran into the occasional celebrity, athlete, you know, social media celebrity. You know, Michelle was there because I think she's Team Callaway, isn't she? Yeah. She's part Callaway, part Nike now. And she was wearing a gold Nike jacket. Paige Spiranak, I ended up realized I was standing next to, is an Instagram star now and aspiring professional golfer. And, you know, so it was an interesting group from that standpoint of just kind of seeing the completely anonymous people who probably have more money than God out there. And then the, you know, the handful of celebrities who are out there as well.
And I, I, I think that could kind of feed into the match itself. I had no idea that some of these folks that you've mentioned were out there. And yeah, I don't really care who the whales are. I mean, I've been in a high limit room. I've played blackjack with whales. They're not that interesting. They're just compulsive gamblers. But at one point, Allison Lee was videoing the players' swings, and she was seen on the stream, and no one mentioned, oh, hey, that's Allison Lee. She was on the Solheim Cup. She's a kick-ass player. She just got a tour card, blah, blah, blah. No mention of that whatsoever. It almost seemed like they went out of their way to avoid that there were really interesting people watching this match.
Yeah, I only knew Allison Lee was there because I was following my Twitter timeline, and somebody else on my timeline mentioned it. And, I think you needed more of that. You needed the best way I think to kind of translate this in a way is like when you watch in the early days when Fox took over the baseball All-Star game, it became more celebrity driven that, you know, they made sure that they had cameras on this, that, and the other person from all the Fox shows. And it was a big deal. You know, some people loved it, some people hated it, whatever.
Right.
I'm not saying you got to go to that extreme, but there are only 1,000 people there. And basically there's a list somewhere of who all those people are. It's not like they let anonymous people in. So if you know who everybody is on the grounds, certainly there should be some opportunity to have some interaction with the celebrities and the athletes who are out there, you know, and get their perspective. You know, to me, that's way more. I know Charles Barkley was funny, but to me, that's way more, I think compelling from, you know, to be able to talk to. I heard one of the criticisms, I saw Natalie Gulbis on the 10th hole. I heard that she was on the broadcast early and then basically they put her in cold storage for the rest of the time or something.
Pretty much,
and, yeah. Yeah. And that seems like that would be the perfect thing for her or Shane, if Shane wasn't the MC, to have those guys doing as well. I don't know. I just think you need much more. You need a better on-course presence. And that's not to say the people who weren't there didn't do a good job. It's to say that the way they planned it, the overall strategy of how to broadcast this thing and to make it something different. That's all we heard on the lead up was, well, this is going to be a different way. That was Phil's number one talking point. This is going to be a different way of viewing sports. This is going to be the future of viewing sports. And we just, I don't think we got that. And I think it's an easy fix to get it.
I feel like that, again, it was kind of stuck between two schools of thought and neither was done very well, but that the kind of guiding principle behind this should have been, this is a spectacle, embrace the spectacle and yes, do everything that you can to make this seem weird and different and important and something other than just two dudes playing for a lot of money that they've already earned because of these rights fees that they got with Turner Sports. And, they got paid. I mean, they got paid regardless of the $9 million purse. So I feel like if they wanted to make it different and they wanted to make it seem cool and interesting, then they should have gone out of their way to kind of point out all the absurdities of it, that there was a small crowd, that this is a very exclusive course, that there are a bunch of people from all kinds of walks of life who have, like you said, more money than God combined on that golf course watching it, and to make that absolutely crystal clear to not only the people watching on TV and streaming it, but the people in person, to make them feel like they were a part of it. And I think that was what was kind of missing, that cohesiveness.
Yeah, and what happened was, because you didn't have that liveliness, I guess, that fun factor to it, both of these guys who are hardcore competitors, and I think felt the pressure of not only the fact of beating each other, because they knew this was going to go down as a moment in history. Obviously, it's not a major, it's nothing like that, but they both took it incredibly seriously, and I think $9 million got inside their heads. We saw it in the golf. I'm the first one. I keep defending the fact that there was a lot of really good golf played that day, but the putting, looked
very
like
tentative.
If you and I were out there and putting for $1,000 on a hole, Ryan, it looked like the way we'd feel.
Yeah.
You know, there was some shaky putting and, from the very get go. You know, neither one of them made the putts on the first hole after they both stuck it in there. I mean, I thought Phil was golden with that on the first hole with the putt he had. And then, you know, you look at how many Tiger missed. The fact that Tiger lost the match all came down to putting, because you know, he hit some outstanding iron shots along the way. And I was looking at some of the shots that were hit. You know, Phil almost aced the fifth. Yeah. I mean, just right over. And I happened to be in the media room when that happened, and everybody was like, "Oh, that would have been a book killer," because the sports books were, I think, offering 100-1 that there would be an ace.
Yeah.
And that would have just savaged them if that one goes in. I think they were on the, well, I mean, Tiger flagged one on the 12th, which is a pretty tricky green. I mean, the pin was in a favorable place. And I think we should mention, as you know, I went out there and I walked the back nine that morning.
Yeah.
Shot pictures of some great pin placements. And then, of course, they went through and neutered half of those holes and had much easier pin placements, which was very unfortunate, because the pin on the drivable par four 11th was just was diabolical. It would have been so cool to have it over there. And the pin on 17, where Tiger chipped in, was in a much more difficult spot too. But there was another hole. What was? Oh, they both drove it in the bunker on 14, which I guess was a long drive hole that didn't materialize. But that shot from that bunker is probably the hardest shot on the golf course, and they both hit it, you know, just over the flag and had it back up. You know, took the slope and backed up down the hole. And so, you know, there was some outstanding golf played when it came to iron shots. And then, of course, Phil, as he proclaimed in the press conference afterward, drove it like a stallion. he drove it unlike we've seen him probably all year.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Tiger had a few wayward ones, obviously, had a few wayward shots here and there, but then Tiger was Tiger and did what he did on 17. So, you know, that's why I never understood all the criticism going into the event. Everybody wanted to be down on it, especially the overseas journalists. You know, I was talking with Bob Herrig from ESPN about it on the bus ride in to the facility. And we were just like, embrace it. Like you just said, embrace it for what it is. It's a one off between these guys. And honestly, I hope it's not. I want to see these two guys play each other again, even if it's part of a bigger thing. And we can talk about that. But, you know, it didn't deserve all the criticism it got. And these guys, you know, yeah, the money, it wasn't life changing money to them because they both got hundreds of millions of dollars. But still, it was enough money to, like we said, make their knees knock in spots, because there were a lot of putts that shouldn't have been missed. And on the flip side, if one of those guys gets hot, you know, what was it? Phil shot 63 in the FedEx Cup, won the FedEx Cup playoffs this year.
Yeah.
You know, both of these guys are capable of getting on a run with the putter.
Yeah.
And if they did, you know, one of them would have shot aggregate 62, 63, something like that.
Yeah.
You know, those guys, they would have rolled on this golf course because they hit so many balls close. So I think to say, well, they didn't play very well, takes away from kind of what the overall spectacle was and how good they really did hit it in a lot of spots.
Yeah, I feel like really the only downside to the play was that they just didn't take opportunities that they had on the greens and convert them. And that's kind of what turned into poo-pooing the whole style of golf. The golf tee to green was really good, I thought, by and large. I mean, there were mistakes, but there weren't that many. And it just was that these guys were not making putts, and they seemed tentative the entire way. And like you said, maybe some facet of the money had part of it. Maybe that they felt nervous that they wanted to deliver a good show to God knows what size audience doing something that's pioneering. I'm sure that played into their psyche somewhat.
Sure.
And then, as you mentioned, and I couldn't get my head around why all the British guys, the British golf writers in particular, were so upset about this notion of a $9 million thing and kind of the focus on betting and money. And it just so happened that kind of the day after the match, read a number of pieces about basically the proliferation of in-play sports betting in the UK, particularly with soccer, and that it's kind of become this scourge over there. So they took an extrapolation from soccer in-play betting and kind of what has fueled the rise of bookies, the rise of their massive advertising budgets, and there's a big controversy over that over there. And then immediately install that on this match, not really thinking about the context of the fact that PAFSPA just got overturned this year, and that states are just starting to really get into sports betting, and the American culture is really just starting to think about it in its conscious way. And so I feel like their criticism came from a place of where we might be 20 years from now, but that they've already been to.
Yeah, I got to tell you, it was strange to me, having lived in Las Vegas for a number of years. My wife grew up there. So we have deep ties to Las Vegas. And when I worked for the paper, you couldn't bet on anything that happened, I think, in the state of Nevada, let alone in Las Vegas. And so, you know, when you could bet college basketball, you couldn't bet on UNLV. You know, and now all that's changing, obviously. The Raiders are coming. The Golden Knights are there. So to walk into a sports book and see props up on the board for Tiger and Phil for a match that was being played across town was you know, it was progress for a golf gambler, I guess, is the way to say it.
And the thing I thought really interesting from the data that they showed during the telecast, obviously they didn't share that with you guys as it went on, probably, but it seemed like it was just an indication that people have no freaking clue how golf works, and that they didn't understand that a lot of holes would probably end in ties, but that you would earn more money betting on one or the other to win, you know, all kinds of various things. And that was really instructive to me, is where we are as a society that's starting to kind of grapple with sports betting becoming a more pervasive thing, and something we acknowledge is legal and, you know, people can actually do. That golf, for all of its betting ability, I mean, it's the most bettable sport, in my opinion, a lot of people don't know what in the world they're doing. So
yeah.
It's going to be really interesting to see as the years go on, as perhaps this concept unfurls a little bit more, and maybe there are more of them, how much more aware and intelligent sports bettors might be about what happens on a golf course, and whether that carries over into in-play betting on week-to-week PGA Tour events.
And for people like you and me, Ryan, that's going to be a good thing, that learning curve. For guys like you and me who want to bet on golf, because that means we're going to get to bet against a lot of suckers for quite a while. Hey, but think about this. Talk about an on-course host who has an earpiece from the producers. What if we told Tiger when he's in the middle of the fairway on whatever the 16th? Hey, Tiger, you're only 30% to win this hole, according to the people who are wagering on the hole. How does that change the dynamic of how these guys think? Because Tiger is one of those guys, you know, these like, well, I'll, you know, he's a,
I'll show them,
Tiger,
yeah.
He is the ultimate I'll show you type of guy. You know, just look at 17. You know, he's down and out. Everybody's ready to close out the match. You know, Phil's going to be right. He had predicted on the HBO special he was going to close it out on 17. Everything looked like that was going to happen. You know, Tiger's going to get down in three. Phil's going to roll in a birdie putt, just as he said. And then Tiger turns around and chips that in. And honestly, when he chipped it in, I mean, if you listen to the broadcast, to a replay, if you can find it anywhere, I still haven't figured out how we're going to find a replay of it. But I think you can hear me laughing on the hillside, because I literally started laughing out loud. I couldn't believe it when he did it. So, I think you're right. There's so much that needs to be done, you know, a little bit differently on the gambling side of this too. And I think you're right. That led to so many people, not just the gambling side of it, because I do think that was a huge part in the UK of the criticism of this, but so many people just thought the money was obscene. And I don't understand that. I mean, to think that golf, especially in a made for television event like this, should be less corporate than all of the rest of sports, which has all become incredibly corporate, just doesn't make any sense. We don't ask, we don't ask Matt Ryan when he loses to Drew Brees. We don't ask him to give his salary to charity.
Right.
You know, or I guess when Drew Brees wins, we don't ask him to give his salary to charity. And on the flip side, we don't ask Matt Ryan to pay Drew Brees when he loses. So this idea that, one, all the money was supposed to go to charity, and or two, that it was supposed to come out of their own pockets, there would just be no reason for those guys to even get out of bed and do this. And yeah. And the people who don't think that a portion or a sizable chunk, I would guess, of that $9 million isn't going to end up going to charity, they're just not paying attention, because the PGA Tour and certainly Tiger and Phil give a lot of money to charity and help facilitate a lot of the charitable giving that happens surrounding the tour. And so I think every, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats type of thing, where this kind of money going into somebody's pocket is definitely going to help all the charitable giving that goes around the tour. We're not going to know exactly how it happens, but, you know, there is evidence, obviously, that that those things happen, and I think this will contribute to it.
Yeah, I feel like I had like a lot of maddening thoughts about the whole thing, about the money component of it, that, okay, well, you were either in one of two camps about the money, that it wasn't a big deal or it was horrible. It wasn't, okay, I'm ambivalent about $9 million, because most people can't be ambivalent about $9 million. But the PGA Tour didn't want them to have a $10 million purse, because the FedEx Cup is $10 million, or at least it was. Now it's $15 million. So I don't understand the tour's objection to that in the first place. That said, and then the other camp was, if you were so against it, was, well, $9 million is a ridiculous amount of money for two players to go for. And besides, these guys are almost billionaires, or one is. Well, then in that case, if you wanted it to mean something, if you wanted to make them uncomfortable, then the purse should have been $50 million, because then you would have had them go, oh, crap, this is life-changing money.
And right.
I thought part of one of the interesting things, rare interesting things, Darren Revelle tweeted was that Phil's $9 million win was basically like you and me winning $1,600 playing golf, which right. sounds great, by the way, but... So $9 million in the grand scheme of things did not mean that much to Phil Mickelson. And it would mean something going to a charity. But both of these guys give a lot to charitable efforts. Phil kind of focuses on STEM education. Actually, so does Tiger. And Tiger has an event, a big charity event, on this golf course every right. single year.
Right.
So I don't understand where all of the kind of... ballyhooing about this whole thing came into place because of the money, because as you mentioned, sports are corporate, there's a lot of money in them, and obviously with the title Capital One's the Match, there was a pretty clear corporate influence from them, from AT&T, from Audi, and I believe there are a couple of other sponsors as well. So it wasn't like going into this you're like, gee willikers, these are just two guys playing for the love of the game on a lovely Friday afternoon. Hell no. They wanted to make some money, and they wanted to prove they could make some money. And it turns out, if Bleacher Report Live could have actually processed payments, they would have made some money. So
yeah.
I think that this concept was validated and that it could go on and survive, but you have to, as we've talked about throughout this podcast, clean it up, reform it a little bit. And something I think that we've touched on but haven't in this is that there needs to be some kind of undercard. There needs to be some other attraction to this if you're going to do it again in the future, because just two guys playing 18 holes of golf, there's a lot of downtime and a lot of space to fill. And I feel like having something else going on either simultaneously or before would help it out.
Yeah, I feel like, and I like to say I came up with that idea, but I think it was one of the overseas journalists. I think it was Michael McEwen who I saw with Bunkered or somebody like that. And as he just hammered away on all that was bad about this, the one thing he wrote in his piece, his preview piece that I agreed with was, you know, getting an undercard. You know, he said even if you had the best player at both of these guys' alma maters, you know, I'm not sure people tune in for that part of a thing. I would like to see, you know, Michelle and Lexi, or, you know, whatever, something like that, possibly. Or you could have four guys, you know, you could have a team event in the earlier going. But then if you have that overlap slightly, so those guys are finishing up their back nine as Tiger and Phil Tiger Phil 2, as we'll start calling it,
yeah.
is teeing off on the on the afternoon part of this match. Then you would have the overlap in those early holes, which were admittedly a little bit slow on the broadcast. And I think that would you turn this into a full day of golf. That leads into the fact that you mentioned Bleacher Report and their fiasco in not being able to make the money that they should have. The hostility toward putting this on pay-per-view, and in my opinion, you know, when you signed up for your cable service or DirecTV or whatever, you weren't expecting to get this. You know, you're expecting to get certain things. You weren't expecting to get this. So paying the extra $20, and the people who would tell me that, oh, well, the average guy can't pay $20. I mean, I have a friend who's hurt for money who couldn't pay $20. I understand there are some people out like that. But for most people, I mean, that's what the average golf fan spends on golf balls in a month, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, I with how many they lose in the water and the weeds. So I'm just saying, you know, you can find most people, you know, let's say 75-80% of the golf watching public can find $20 to be able to watch the two greatest players of their generation, essentially, go at it head to head. And you know, that was another thing that they're too, you know, these guys are too far past their prime. That was another one of these that I just didn't understand. It's 15, 20 years too late. You know, these guys, what was it? One of them was eighth. One of them was 13th on the money list. Tiger Woods almost won the FedEx Cup.
Yeah.
He was second place in the FedEx Cup. And what they don't tell you, you're talking about money and everything. What most people, most casual golf fans don't realize, they hear about the grand prize for winning the FedEx Cup, whatever Justin Rose got $10 million this year, right?
Yep.
Well, but Tiger won $3 million for finishing second.
Yeah.
We don't talk about what the overall purse is of the FedEx Cup as much as we do about what that grand prize is. $3 million for coming in runner-up is pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, these guys – it's not like they are two has-beens who are just slogging it out on the Champions Tour at this point. These two guys are playing golf at an exceptionally high level, especially for being well into their 40s. You know, Phil won an event, like I mentioned earlier. He's gone low on a number of occasions. I knew there was no way. Somebody said this was going to be, you know, the biggest mismatch since Siegfried and Roy against the Tigers or something like that. And they thought Phil had no chance. And I never believed that because I was like, if Phil gets on, he's going to go low and he's going to take this incredibly seriously. He wants to beat Tiger. And that's exactly what we saw. He had a game plan. He came out. He executed it. He played near flawless golf, except for the fact that he couldn't putt, and he got into one bunker situation where he did the unthinkable, because we don't expect Phil Mickelson with a wedge in his hand in a bunker to hit it into another bunker. We expect him to knock it stiff every time. And really, the turn of events on that hole on the front nine, where he dunked it into another bunker on the par five. Meanwhile, Tiger hit a chip to gimme range, and you know, that was one of many turning points in the match that made it and showed the nerves, you know, that Phil. I mean, you give Phil that shot, I bet 98 out of 100 times he hits it within 10 feet of the pin. And in this case, it catches a little heavy, puts it in another bunker. But to me, that's the only bad shot I could think of all day. I mean, there were some wayward drives, and
right.
You know, Tiger let a few on the fifth. Tiger let his iron shot get out to the right, but he still hit the green. You know, Phil, that was the only bad shot I could think of all day, which goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that this was a lot better golf match than people give it credit for.
Yeah, I feel like going into it, I thought Tiger would probably win, and he would probably win like 3-2 or something like that. But it wouldn't be some kind of like he wouldn't get Stephen Ames. Like, Phil wouldn't get 9-8 out the way here. It wouldn't work like that. They're just too good, and there's too much pride on the line. And my caveat to saying that Tiger would win was that Phil is clearly taking this more seriously, because it was his it wasn't totally his idea, but it was his idea to needle Tiger into it, to get him to agree to it, that he wanted to shepherd this from concept to execution to finish, and that it wanted to come across well, and that it could be repeated not only for them, but for younger players of a different generation so that maybe they can take a step toward controlling their marketing and branding and financial opportunities separate from the PGA Tour. There was a lot packaged into what Phil wanted to accomplish with this, and Tiger, I'm sure, too, but more Phil. And so that, I think, carried him more in this match than anything, was he wanted this to go really well because of so much he felt was riding on it. And that probably fueled his performance to some extent. He went out and charted Shadow Creek. He got it back fresh in his memory. I know him and Tiger both have had the course record there at different points in time, but Phil had to reacclimate himself, and he did all the stuff he felt he had to do to prepare for it. Meanwhile, Tiger just kind of showed up and did minimal preparation and thought that might be good enough to carry him. And turns out it wasn't. And Phil,
right.
Phil was better. And so I think that's why it felt actually genuinely serious. And toward the end, those guys got into their kind of traditional modes of operation. That Tiger became quiet and reserved and wanted to be a killer because he wanted to win. And Phil was just looking for someone to kind of chat it out with because that's how he deals with those situations.
Right.
I honestly thought once they got to about 11 or 12, the match became more interesting because it went from spectacle, which should have been emphasized at the beginning, to golf match, which it became at the end.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I mean, I think you're dead on with that. Phil was the voice of this thing. Obviously, together they did a lot of media, and separately they did a lot of media. Mostly in the separate ones, they were kind of talking trash, you know, at arm's length to each other. But when they were together in the press conference, in the appearances that I saw, on ESPN and other places, Phil was the mouthpiece of this. He was the guy with the talking points, and he was the guy who kind of directed the answers the way they wanted to. He wanted things to be accomplished by this, in addition to winning it. And I think he succeeded to some part of this. And I know he and Tiger and Phil had a lot to do with the details of how this thing was put together. I just think there are some more details for this to be a success. I think it can be a highly successful thing year after year, like the Skins game was for years. But I think it needs to be rethought from a standpoint of kind of how it's produced. And if you're going to promise something that's different than anything else, you need to deliver something that's different than anything else.
One thing I wanted to run by you before we kind of close up shop and kind of final thoughts is, you mentioned it, the Skins game. There was some kind of romanticism and talk about, well, maybe we should bring back the Skins game. It's been gone long enough that we could bring it back and people might miss it. And I think that that's actually true. And I'm wondering if the next version of this, and it doesn't have to be Tiger Phil 2, maybe we can wait a little while and delay that, whatever. But that a version of this could be the Skins game that actually is a high-dollar Skins game that has a $10 million total purse or some kind of absurd figure like that, where there is action on every hole. Because for the average sports viewer, not the average golf fan, but for the average sports viewer, you can get pretty bored by golf early on because you're building to something. It's coming to something. You're not doing this right away. You're not getting the immediate payoff in golf. But if in a Skins game, you can have a payoff 18 different times. And so every hole matters. So I'm wondering, if they were to do this again, what would your thoughts be on having a similar size purse, but do it with a Skins game, and then add in the betting component that we talked about earlier?
Well, sorry, I think two things on that. I think if we're going to have Tiger Phil 2, it needs to happen next year, because we don't know how long we're going to have Tiger and Phil.
True.
And so, you know, I think if you want to do this with them, that's what you need to work toward. I'm all in favor of the Skins game. I think it would be awesome. I think of all the different personalities that you can get into a group of four. And, Eddie Pepperell was hammering this event right and left from his side of the pond. I would like to see them bring him over. You know, he mentioned like 100 guys could beat Tiger on any given week, and maybe that's true in 144 person field technically, but I don't think Eddie Pepperell is one of them. So let's bring him bring him over and let's see what he does. And I kind of felt like his whole shtick was angling to be in on one of these things anyway, because because he could certainly use the prize money. But I think the skins game would be great. I think somebody put this out. I don't remember who it was. I read it somewhere in the massive stuff leading up to this. It might have been my friend Nate Carr up in Alaska, who said he's embracing the silly season. We need more silly season. The fact that the tour got, when it became a year-round season, I think kind of detract from the fun of it, because now you've got hardcore events after the FedEx Cup leading up to the Tournament of Champions.
Yeah.
And, you know, that used to be the time that we got all the cool stuff. You know, the fun stuff, the stuff that was different. And, you know, I want to see more of those types of events, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I think that's the takeaway here, is that this doesn't always have to be pay-per-view. It doesn't always have to be Tiger Field. It doesn't have to be all of these things all at the same time. But stuff like this actually is good for golf, because it's different and it's entertaining. And we spend way too much time thinking about how serious and special and blah, blah, blah bullshit golf is at a professional level. And sometimes we just have to remember it's a game and it should be a good time. And I would like to see these guys, and gals for that matter, have a good time playing golf.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, there are two things I wanted to mention, too, that came back to you know, these conflicts that people had, or I mean, not conflicts, but criticisms that people had. And one was, we're talking about different types of events. The World Cup was this weekend, and, you know, it's a different event. It's a team event, representing your country and whatever. And that was one of the big criticisms was, well, this is going to take away, the match is going to take away from the World Cup. And so I kind of kept an eye on the coverage of that while I was at the match. And I left the golf course after the match. I left an hour after the final putt had been holed. I left Shadow Creek on a bus going the wrong way, which is a whole nother story for a different time. But I looked at my phone as I got in the car, and the leaders, Leishman and Smith at the time, were on the seventh hole. So there's no way that this conflicted. You could watch the entire, you know, you could have got into golf, watched the match in its entirety, then flipped over and watched the back nine of the World Cup of Golf and just been, you know, been fine. It would have been like any other day. It would have been like a day when you're watching football and you go from game to game to game. So I think that was one of those things where people were just completely searching for, you know, well, how can we hammer this thing? You know, how can we throw cold water on this whole thing? The other thing, and I was talking about Shadow Creek, and I think Shadow Creek worked out perfectly. I wrote a whole piece, you know, that people can go read on Golf News Net about why Shadow Creek is kind of the ideal place to do something like this, especially since they wanted to hold it in Las Vegas. And they were kind of giving it a boxing match feel and all of that. But I saw a lot of people who said, well, if you're going to do something like this, it needs to be at a historic venue like Pebble or the Old Course or Carnoustie. And I haven't seen anybody refute that. And here is the reason why. And this is where, you know, kind of my Talking Golf Getaway side takes over. Plus the fact that I spend, you know, as you know, and listeners of our show know, I spend a great deal of time working on a project, a golf course, Pacific Gales, that's going to get built up on the Oregon coast. So I understand golf operations a little bit more than some. And you just simply couldn't hold an event of this type in this short of time at one of those places. You would have to shut those courses down. And places like Pebble and Carnoustie and the Old Course are booking out all of their tee times months and months and sometimes years in advance.
Yeah.
So if you're going to hold something like this, it's got to be kind of at a private course that has that luxury. Shadow Creek had the luxury of just saying, okay, well, nobody's going to play, you know, this week, and, you know, we're going to do this thing. And I'm sure they got paid for, you know, using it and all that type of thing. But you can't say, you know, well, 3 months from now, we're going to go play this thing at Pebble Beach, because you got resort guests who have, you know, booked out all the hotels and booked out all the golf and everything. And so somebody else mentioned Cypress Point, which I just think from a prestige standpoint, they're never going to host something like this. But, you know, that's to me why this kind of private yet high roller hybrid course, because Shadow Creek's not a private club, but it takes a lot of money to be able to play there, is the perfect kind of venue for this kind of thing, and why, you know, holding it at these other places, just it wouldn't work unless you plan this thing. Maybe now that it's on the schedule, you know, because I know the tour has put it on the schedule for future years, you know, maybe now you can look out 2-3 years and say, well, the one in 2021 is going to be at wherever. But in terms of doing this first one, there was no way to do it anywhere, I think, other than Shadow Creek.
I think that you're right. I feel like any criticism about the venue is kind of misplaced. There's only so many places you can do this on the fly. They originally wanted to do this, I believe, July 4th weekend or something like that. It didn't work out. They didn't have the money lined up. They didn't have everything lined up to do it on the Turner side. So they needed basically a relatively quick 90-day turnaround from contract to execution. And there aren't that many places that can do that. There just are not. And like you mentioned, in the future doing something like this, there is a potential there, I think, where you could bid it out. You could go to, like you do with the Ryder Cup or a President's Cup, and say, all right, well, you want to host this weird sideshow of golf? You're gonna pony up for it, and we'll have events around it, and it, you know, we'll envelop your city, and it'll be really cool, but you're going to pay for it. And that is probably a future monetization of this for Tiger, Phil, their holding company, and everyone involved, is to get the cities themselves involved. And there really was no other city that can embrace a weird spectacle put together in a hurry quite like Las Vegas. So for all of those reasons, Vegas made perfect sense, and so did Shadow Creek made perfect sense to host this thing.
I'm going to lobby for calling this thing the Weird Sideshow of Golf now instead of the match. I think you've renamed it. I think that's what it should be called.
They could call it whatever they want, but it's a weird sideshow, and I loved it. I enjoy it, and I admittedly came in as a skeptic. I thought no one would watch it. I thought it would go horribly, and yes, there were lots of glitches with it. That's what happens the first time you do something, but the concept isn't bad. It's salvageable, and I think that it can be better the next time with a lot of the things that we talked about being improved.
Yep, I totally agree.
Well, Darren, I want to thank you for coming on and talking with me about this. I'm so glad you got a chance to go see this and report on this for us. You did a great job down there. And thank you for coming on and kind of sharing your experience and the insights about the match.
Thank you. And, you know, people want to know more about Las Vegas golf, should listen to Talking Golf Getaways. I'm sure we'll have we'll have quite a few episodes probably about Las Vegas in one way or another coming up in 2019.
And if you're not subscribed to the Talking Golf Getaways podcast, what are you doing with your life? Get on wherever you get your podcasts. iTunes, obviously most popular, but wherever else. And, of course, you can go to golfnewsnet.com and find out all the ways you can subscribe to Talking Golf Getaways through our website as well. So thanks again, Darren.
Thank you.
Thanks to Darren again for coming on the show. It was great to talk to him. I mean, it just we don't normally get to talk too often about actual golf. I mean, we talk about other stuff, you know, business, strategy, things like that, but to be able to actually talk and have him on my podcast after him and Darren, him and Mitch have been so kind to have me on theirs in the past, it was cool to return the favor and actually talk about something a little bit different than golf travel, more my end of the business than theirs, and it worked out great. So thanks to Darren for coming on. We still have a few more shows left in the year. We'll try to do a couple of others. So this week, we obviously don't have anything on the PGA Tour, but we do have the Aussie PGA Championship. We have the Mauritius Open. I hope I'm saying that right, on the European Tour, and really don't have much beyond that. But we obviously have the Hero World Challenge to consider. That is really the last kind of star-laden event of the year. It's an 18-man field, I understand. It's a silly season event. It probably means less to the game ultimately than the match did, but still fun golf. It's still high-level golf, top-tier players playing in what will turn out to be December 2nd on Sunday. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And then maybe one more show after that, button it up for the year, and then we'll come back at the beginning of 2019 and get it all started again. So hope you enjoyed this show. Hope you enjoyed the interview with Darren. We're going to try to do more of these in the future, have more guests. We're actually have Nathan Crace on the show. He's a golf course architect who's doing some great work right now at the Refuge Golf Club down in Mississippi, which is he's doing a total gut redo, which is going to be great. And he's actually kicking up a podcast of his own. So I can't wait to talk to him about that and the work that he's doing down there, because he shares some really cool pictures, really cool detail behind what actually happens when a golf course architect renovates a place, when a golf course architect totally guts a place. And the insight is just spectacular. So make sure you give us a 5-star rating if you listen to us on iTunes. Helps us reach more people. We appreciate that. And tell a friend about us. Wouldn't hurt. So until next time, I'm Ryan Balaji saying thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.